Okay, we're beginning here, three lines down on the top of Mem Dalet Amud Aleph. Amar Mar, Iboye Bahai Gavyo, Iboye Bahai Gavyo. From yesterday's daf, we concluded when there were two shtarot that were written on the same transaction, we said that the person has the right to collect with either of the two contracts. One cancels the other. For instance, where the earlier contract, which is dated earlier, has a smaller figure in it, whether that's a monetary gift, whether that is a sale, it has a smaller number in it. In the second contract, there is a larger number in it or a larger transaction in it. So the individual has a choice. They can either collect from the earlier date, but the smaller amount, or they can collect with the shtar that has the later date, the larger amount. But it's up to the individual who has the shtar to make that choice. And again, it's one cancels the other. Lema plige de Rav Nachman. Let us suggest that that conclusion is something that disagrees with the position of Rav Nachman. Damar Rav Nachman, shnei shtarot yotzim bezeh achar zeh. When you have two shtarot that are memorializing the same transaction, bitel sheni et arishon. The second one trumps and cancels the first contract. So you see over here, based on Rav Nachman's statement, we don't say that it's up to the recipient to make the decision as to which star that they use, but rather the second contract trumps. We say that the second contract replaces the first contract. Mar says, Lav mi itmar ala. Then we already have a qualification of that statement of Rav Nachman, that Amar Rav Papa, Umode Rav Nachman. Papa says that Rav Nachman agrees, Di'i osipe dikla, that if the second contract has something additional in it, for instance, it adds in an additional palm tree to the transaction, then the second contract's not coming to nullify or negate the first contract. It's simply coming to add on what was left out of the first contract. So hachanami. So to over here, ha'usif le midai. So that's the same thing in the case here with Rav Huna that we saw in yesterday's daf. That the reason that we say that the Mekabel has the right to choose which contract that they utilize is because the second contract had something additive in it. There was more in the second contract. So therefore, Rav Nachman would not disagree with that conclusion that we had with Rav Huna. Now, as far as the view of this Shnei Shtarot, these two Shtarot, Rashi over here discusses the fact that we are speaking about Shtarei Mecher, Shtarei Matana, and Ketubah, which are all the examples that are brought here. The Rif actually goes out of his way to say that this does not apply to Shtarei Halva'ah. This does not apply to loan documents. Therefore, if we have two loan documents that are for the same amount or seemingly the same transaction, we'll not assume that the second contract overrides the first contract, but rather we will assume that there are actually two loans over here, and that the documentation is a documentation of two separate loans. So this statement of Rav Nachman that the second one nullifies the first one is only in transactional type of contracts like Mecher, Matana, and Ketubah. That's when we say it. And again, if there's something additive to the contract, then Rav Nachman will agree to what Rav Huna said yesterday, that the second contract is not coming to negate the first contract, but rather to offer an alternative. If you want the larger amount, then you get it from the latter date. If you want the smaller amount, you can take it from the earlier date. And it's the way that Rashi and most of the Rishonim view that. The Ritva does bring down from the Aruch that over here, we would believe when there's Osip Badikla, that you could bifurcate the contracts and say that the core amount could be collected from the first date. And the Osif, the additional amount that's added in the second contract, could be collected from the latter date. So rather than the way that Rashi's explaining it, that it's one cancels the other and you get your choice. Either you get the earlier date and the smaller amount, or the latter date and the larger amount. The way that the Aruch explains here, the Osif Beidikla, is that the core amount will always be collected from the earlier date. If you want then to collect the additional amount, that additional amount will only be allowed to be collected from the second date. So Gufa, the Gemara wants to investigate further this statement of Rav Nachman. Amar Rav Nachman, shnei shtarot hayotzim bezeh achar zeh, bitel sheni et harishon. You have two contracts that are memorializing, again, the same transaction. Then the second one negates the first contract. Amar Rav Papa, Moder Rav Nachman, and we saw this qualification of Rav Papa before, that Rav Nachman agrees the Osipe Dikla le Tosefet Kitave, that they add on something to it, then it's clear that they did this intentionally to add on the additional item that is there. Where it says, Pshito, it's very clear, Rishon b'mecher, v'sheni b'matana. If the exact same transaction between parties, in the first instance, the contract calls it a sale, and in the second contract, it calls it a gift, the apot kochohu dichtivle. The reason that the second contract was written was in order to grant additional powers to the buyer over here, mishum dina de bar mitzra, because of the principle of adjacent fields. There is a din in the Gemara that if an individual sells a field, the neighboring parties, the neighboring fields, have a right of first refusal to buy the field. If they are willing to pay the same number, the same amount as any third party that's willing to buy the property, then they have the first right of refusal. Because of the Gemara basically says, Zenenet is lechaser. As far as the seller is concerned, he's getting the same amount of money. So he's indifferent as to which party buys it. And obviously for the party that has an adjacent field, there's significantly more interest and benefits from the fact that he buys an adjacent field because of the economies of scale. And therefore, why should he not sell it to his neighbor versus selling it to the third party when the neighbor will benefit and he loses out nothing? So this Dina de Bar Metzra, which basically means that fields that are adjacent to a field being sold have the first right of refusal, only applies to sales when the person is selling it. When it comes to a matanah, to a gift, the Dina de Bar Metzra is not relevant, because obviously he intends to give the gift to this person and not to anyone else. So the first right of refusal cannot be exercised in that case. So what this individual did was he sold the field to him, but he wants him to have rights to maintain the field and not have to give it up to the adjacent owners. So he writes again a second contract that is a contract that is a matana. And since matana is not subject to bar mitzra, that will protect him. Now, obviously, as Rashi points out, if he pulls out both contracts, then, of course, there will be a Dina de Bar Metzra, because they know that it's a sale. The intention of writing this second contract is to have the individual who received it or bought this field only utilize that contract and only pull out that contract, where the other parties have no idea that he bought the field. Because if they do know that he bought the field, then obviously they do have a right of Bar Metzra. Here is in a case where it may not be clear to them how the field came into his possession. By having this contract that is a matana, he is able to then circumvent the problem of Dina de Bar Metzra. Now, Tosafot points out over here, even in an instance where Dina de Bar Metzra would not be relevant, for instance, the individual himself also owns an adjacent field, and therefore there wouldn't be a Dina de Bar Metzra, we possibly would still say that the second contract does not nullify the first contract if the second contract is a matana, because Tosafot says that there are other issues or rights that might come up when you deal with a matana versus a mecher. For instance, when a person sells, there is a daya that he sells be'ayin ra'ah, that he gives the least amount for the payment or the purchase that was done. On the other hand, everybody agrees by matana, by a gift, that people are generally generous with their gifts. And therefore, for instance, if there was a necessity to determine whether there was access to this field granted, in the case of Mecher, we would assume no, that there was no access to the field granted, and he would have to buy access to the field. On the other hand, if it was given as a matana, we'd assume that there was access granted. So there are other nafkaminot besides the din of bar metzra, the right of first refusal of the neighboring fields, that would make it that a shtar matana improves the standing of the individual versus a shtar mecher. And therefore, in most instances, we would say that the second shtar does not override the first shtar, but rather is coming to grant additional rights to the individual, and therefore does not nullify the first shtar. V'chol shekein, and certainly in a case that rishon is b'matana, b'sheni b'mecher, the first contract classifies their transaction as being a gift, and the second contract classifies it as a mecher, as a sale, to Amrinon, again there we say that the second contract is not coming to nullify the first contract, Mishom Dino de Balchov Hu Dichtav Kain, but rather because he wanted to give him the right of a Balchov, of a creditor. Because in a case of a Matana, generally there is no recourse to the grantor of the matana. So therefore, if that field was taken by creditors, the individual who was the recipient of the gift would have no recourse against the grantor of the gift. On the other hand, if he writes it as a sale contract, then if that field was taken away by creditors, the individual, the recipient, would then have the right to go back to the grantor and say, give me more money, or give me my money back, or give me replacement land. And therefore, he writes it as a shtar mecher, even though it might have been a shtar matana, to improve his standing as a creditor of the estate in case other creditors come and take this land away. So in both of those instances, Rav Nachman would agree that the writing of the second contract has a reason, and that reason is enough for us to say that it does not nullify the first contract. Ela ishnehem b'mecher, ishnehem b'matana. If both contracts are memorializing either a transaction that was a sale purchase, or they were both about a gift, then bitel sheni et rishon. That's where Rav Nachman says that the second contract comes and nullifies the first contract. My taima. What's the reasoning behind Rav Nachman's position here that we assume that the second contract comes and nullifies the first contract? Rafram amar, emar oduye odile. Because basically we say that the recipient over here is basically acknowledging the fact that there was a problem with the first contract, and they wrote the second contract to overcome the problem in the first contract. Rav Acha Amar Omer Achule Achle Lishibude. That the reason he wrote the second contract is because the individual relinquished his rights or encumberment that came from the first contract, that he forgives that right, and therefore the second contract now reinitiates or reinvests him with that right, a shibud, an encumberment based on the dating of the second contract. Now the Rishonim argue about this statement of Achuli Achle Shibudei, whether really it's simply the relinquishing of his encumberment based on the dating in the contract, but he does not give up on the fact that he actually bought the property. He says, I bought the property, but I'm relinquishing that date of encumberment and saying that I'll come to the later date. Or does it really mean that he basically says that the transaction did not exist from the first contract? It only exists from the beginning of the second contract. Over here, Tosafot deals with what the shibud, or what relevance the shibud has with regards to a shtar matana, because generally shibud is only relevant with regards to a shtar mecher. So Tosfot brings down two nafkaminot, possibly, even for a shtar matana with regards to the shibud. My benayhu, what is the nafkamina between these two different reasonings behind why Rav Nachman says that the second contract nullifies the first contract? Iker benayhu, the difference between them is, oruye sahade, is the status of the edim that are signed on the first contract. The way that Rashi reads this, and most disagree with that, you can see it in Tosfot, that Rashi says over here that the edim on the first contract, according to Rafram, are edim sulim now, and they can no longer testify. They have now lost their nemanut with regards to edut because of the fact that we've now cast aspersions on that first contract. Whereas, according to Rav Acha, then this has nothing to do with the edim. It all has to do with the recipient over here and his relationship with the field and the seller, but nothing to do with the edim themselves. So Rashi over here says that this ruins the reputation of these edim, and they may not testify. They're going to become edim sulim in any other instance. Most of the Rishonim, including Tosafot over here, note that that seems far-reaching. And since when can we just be posel edim in this manner? So what we say is that this individual over here is agreeing that the first shtar had a problem with it. And since he agrees that the first shtar had a problem with it, whether it was a forgery, whether there was some other issue with that, that causes us to question this shtar that has these edim that are signed on it. Therefore, if this individual, the same individual, pulls out any other shtar with these edim signed on it, we will not give credence to that shtar. We will not accept that shtar with these edim on it. But it's very limited. It's limited to this individual who admits there's a problem with the shtar and has these same edim on it. So any other shtar with these same edim and with this party involved with it, then we will question the authenticity of the contract. But otherwise, these edim are clearly edim kshevim, and we're not going to ruin or sully their reputation just based on the fact that he says there was, or we're suspecting there was, a problem with this first contract. So that's the way most of the Rishonim learn, and that would be true according to Rafram, but according to Rav Acha, there has nothing to do with the edim at all. Another nafkamina between them is the shlumei peyrei, whether the individual has to pay for the peyrot, the output of the field, in the interim period. So according to Rafram, where the first contract was completely nullified, and the second contract now is really the sale document, then any output of the field that was taken by the buyer will have to be compensated for, will have to be paid to the seller. On the other hand, according to Rav Acha, the sale actually took place from the first date, and only on the second date did the shibud, his encumberment against the seller's property, start. But he still owned it from the first date, and therefore the output of the field that he consumed is considered to be his, and he does not have to repay it. Ulematasko. And the other issue is with regards to who has to pay the taxes on the property. According to Rafram, the seller is on the hook for the taxes, because we've now said that the sale did not really take place from the first date. It really took place from the second contract, and therefore the obligation of the taxes on the land were the seller's. On the other hand, according to Rav Acha, where it's simply a change about the encumberment, but the sale actually took place from the first date, it's clear that the tax burden lies with the buyer because he did own the land from the first date. My havi ala d'ktuba. What is the din here with regards to a ktuba? Tashma. The amar of Yehuda mar Shmuel, mishum Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Shimon, mane mataim menaurusin. The Tosefet Mina Nisuin, the 100 and 200, the core part of the Ketubah, collects from the time of the Erusin, whereas the Tosefet, the additional items that the husband added into the Ketubah, will only happen from the Nisuin. V'chachamim omrim, echadzeh Mina Nisuin, that they, whether it is the core of the Ketubah, the 100 or 200 zuos for an almanah and a bitulah, or it's the Tosef, the additional items that are added on, they are all from the second date or from the time of the Nisuin. The Hilchata, and the Halacha the Gemara says, is Echadze Vechadze Min HaNisuin. That both of them, that the Halacha is that everything starts from the date of the Nisuin, and therefore the rights to both the Maneh Matayim as well as the Tosef only start from that date of Nisuin, and not from the beginning of the Erusin. Over here, Tosafot says, how did the Gemara come to this conclusion? This seems against many of the principles that we know in Psak, as well as the flow of the Gemara. And he says, Tema Leri, V'hashta maskina dechadze v'chadze minesuim, afagav de'usif la, upligia de Rav Nachman. Says, first of all, it's clear that when you write the Ketubah, the husband says that I add on top of the 100 or 200 zuz, I add on this. So if he's adding it on, and that's the contract at the time of Nisuin, it should be additive to that which took place at the Erusin. And even Rav Nachman agrees in that case that it does not nullify the first agreement or the first contract. So why isn't the Maneh O Matayim from the time of the Erusin? We also have a principle in Halacha that when it comes to Dine, Halacha ke Rav Nachman. So why isn't the Halacha like Rav Nachman? Number two is, we just read a whole Gemara here where Rafram Rav Acha argue within the Shita of Rav Nachman. So you have later Amoraim arguing within the Shita of Rav Nachman. That's also usually a good indication that the Halacha is like Rav Nachman. So now, Tosafot has to somehow differentiate in this case of Ketubah to the cases that we mentioned before in order to reconcile the Psak Halacha over here. And therefore, over me, the Halacha Afagav de'ika Tosefet bitelet rishon. That even over here, there is an addition. The way that it's written is that the husband adds on this on top of the 100 or 200 zuas. Nevertheless, it does nullify the first contract. The time of Mishum Deleka, Shtar Ketuba Beirusin. That there is no Shtar by the Erusin. Ela Mitnai Beitin. It's only a Tnai Beitin that from the time of Erusin, the woman is entitled to her Maneh Matayim. But there is no Shtar Ketuba that's actually written. Hilkach Nitbatel Tnai Rishon Ayude Shtar. And therefore, when you write the Shtar Ketubah by the time of the Nisuin, even though it's written as being additive or adding on, nevertheless, that is a nullification of the first, not contract, but the rights that were granted by Beit Din or Tanai Beit Din by the time of the Erusin. And therefore, since there was no contract written at the time of Erusin, the second contract here will govern with regards to everything, because the rights to collect from the Erusin were not really written or documented in a contract, but rather they are conditions of Beit Din, or rights that the woman has. And through this, Tosafot is able to reconcile the conclusion of the Gemara with regards to Ketubah with what the Gemara had said earlier with regards to other types of contracts. Right now, the Gemara continues with a Mishnah. The Mishnah seemingly is connected to what we've said until now by Ones and Mefateh, because it discusses Motzi Shemra, which Motzi Shemra also involves Kenas, and therefore this Mishnah is brought together with these other Mishnayot, which is a Gioret Shenitgayra Bita Ima, a woman who converts, and along with her comes her daughter. Now, as Tosafot points out over here, the reason that it's not set up simply as Hagioret, the someone who converted, but rather someone who converted and the daughter came along with her, is because the age of the daughter here is below 3 years in one day. And since she can't come of her own volition, because the Beit Din would only work on behalf of a Ktana or Katan to help them convert if they came of their own volition and said that they wanted to convert. But over here, it's clear she's too young to even make such a claim. So the only way that we can have a Gioret, who is clearly a Bitula, is in a case where she converts under the age of 3 years in one day, and that would require her to convert along with her mother. So the Mishnah sets up the case in that instance to teach us that we're talking about even a Gioret Bitula, who converted under the age of 3 years and one day. Although if you look in the Rambam, the Perusha Mishnayot, he seemingly thinks that the whole problem in our Mishnah here is that a Gioret is not considered to be a Bitula. That is similar to what we've seen in previous Mishnayot here in the Masechta. And therefore, for him, it has to be Dafka that she converted after the age of 3 years and one day. And therefore, it's a little more difficult to explain the Lashon according to that Shita of the Rambam. But here, a Gioret Shingara Bita Ima, Vizinta. And then she has Nut. But here she has Nut when during Erusin. So she is a Ne'ara Amurasa, and the din of a Ne'ara Amurasa, generally, who has an extramarital affair, is that she's Nidon Biskila. She gets killed by stoning. But Harizu Bechenek, on the other hand, this woman, this Gioret, who converted, and again, even under the age of 3 years and one day, so she is a Bitula. So now she is a Ne'ara Bitula Me'urasa. She has an extramarital affair. She is only subject to the death penalty by chenek. Ein la lo petach beit av, velo me'asela. And in a case of motzi shemra, she does not have petach ha'av, which we're going to see that the psukim by motzi shemra say that if this girl did act in this manner, then the sentencing and execution of the girl is done outside of the house of her father, because we say, how did this family or how did these parents bring up such a girl? And there's also lo me'asela. There's also not the fine for motzi shemra. Because as we're going to see in the Gemara, the whole parsha of motzi shemra emphasizes that it has to be a Yisrael. And since this girl does not qualify because she is a gioret, and we'll discuss exactly what that means in the Gemara, but therefore she is excluded from all the dinim of the parsha of motzi shemra. Hayata horata shelo b'kdusha. If she was conceived prior to the conversion, but she was born after the conversion of her mother, harizo biskila, then she is subject to the death penalty like any other nara muasa of skila, veina lo petach veitav velo measela, but she still is precluded or excluded from the dinim of having to be stoned outside of her father's house, as well as the rights to collect the measela if the individual lied about this incident and then is caught lying. If she was conceived and born as an Israelite, then she is a full-fledged Israelite, and therefore subject to all the rules of Motzi Shemra. She does have a father, but she does not have a doorway to her father's house. Basically, her father does not own a house. If her father did own a house, but her father has passed away already, then in each of these cases, harizu b'skila, then this girl is still subject to skila, lo nemar petach beit av elo de mitzvah, because these items are not to ma'akev the punishment. They are just an enhancement to what has to happen in the parsha of Motzi Shemra. So just, we should read the psukim that are associated with Motzi Shemra, because the Gemara is about to discuss them, as well as the fact that it's easier then to understand what the Gemara is asking over here, or explaining over here. So it says that, V'lachul zikneir hayi et ha'ish v'iru oto. So this is a case by which the man came and lied about the fact that this woman did not have betulim when he married her. Then banshu oto mea kesef. Then he is punished with a fine of 100 shekel kesef. V'natnu la via na'ara ki utzi shem ra'o betulat Yisrael. He has to give them to the father of the na'ara because he was motzi shem ra on a betulat Yisrael. V'lo tia li'isha, and she will be for him a wife. Lo yuchal l'shalecha ko yamav, he may not divorce her ever. V'me'met haya davar hazeh. If it was true, lo nimtzu bitulim la'na'ara, and this girl really did have an extramarital affair, v'otziu et ha'na'ara u'petach beit aviha, then they will take this na'ara to the doorway of her father's house, uskolua, and they will stone her there. Anshe yirab avanim v'meita, they will stone her to death and she will die. Ki aseta nevala b'Yisrael, because she said, did something that was terrible, unacceptable amongst Klal Yisrael, lisnot beit avia, because she had these improper relationships, ubiyarta rami b'kibecha, and therefore you eliminate this bad from amongst you. So now the Gemara is going to focus on a number of words that are used here. One of them we just saw in the Mishnah, which is el petach beit avia, the door of her father's house. Here the Mishnah tells us that we don't take that literally. That's number one. Uskalua ancheira bavanim vameta, that they will stone her. And then the word vameta, which seemingly here is extraneous, that of course if they're going to stone her, the point of stoning her is that it's a death penalty. Vameta is considered to be extraneous. And then the last one is ki astatan valam biyisrael. They're going to focus on this word biyisrael, that it seemingly only applies to Israelim gimurim. Now that seems to be built upon what was said earlier in the psukim, which is, Ki hotzi shemra al bitulat Yisrael. So since it already says that ki hotzim shemra al bitulat Yisrael, over here again, when it mentions ki asda nevala b'Yisrael, we're going to take that Yisrael together with the bitulat Yisrael very literally and say that therefore it precludes some instances like we saw over here of giorit. So now we're going to go to the Gemara that after we've seen these psukim to understand what was going on in the Mishnah. It says, v'nahane mile, from where do we know this? That, as Rashi points out, shahorata shelo biktusha, v'leidata biktusha, if she was conceived prior to the conversion and born after the conversion, that she still gets skila. Amar Resh Lakish, amar kra umeita. It says, and we saw this in the psukim, that with regards to the stoning, uskolua anshei rabba avanim, vameita. That meita is the rabot, horata shelo biktusha, v'leidata biktusha. That is to include a case where she was conceived prior to the conversion of her mother and was born after the conversion. Ihachi, if that's the case that you are mirabeh her for the parsha of Motzi Shemra, why are you only including her for the death penalty of Skila? Ihachi milka nami lilke, umeya sela nami lishalim. Then so too by the individual who is found to be lying about this, the husband who lies about this with regards to this girl, he should be subject to Malkot, and should be subject to the penalty or the fine of Mea Sela. Samakra Umeita, Lemita Nitrabta, Velodiknas. So therefore, the Meita is written within the Sugya, within the Parshia there of the stoning, or when the girl is found to be guilty, and therefore the Reboy is only associated with the death penalty, and not with regards to anything else inside of the Parsha. Ve'ema Rabot, Horata v'leidata b'kdusha. Why don't we say that that comes to include a case where she was both conceived and born b'kdusha? Hahi Israelit maliyotahi. Why do you need a special pasuk for that? That girl is a full-fledged Israelit. She was conceived after her mother's conversion. She was born after her mother's conversion. She is a full-fledged Jew. So the verse says you don't need a meita to come to include that. So v'ema l'rabot. Horata veledata shelo bikdusha. So why do you say the word meita here comes to include a girl who was both conceived and born prior to the conversion of her mother, and then converted along with her mother? Imkain bi Israel mayahani le. If that's the case, then the word Yisrael, what did it do from you in the Pasuk? What does it come to exclude? So again, here we have a tension between the word Meita, which is inclusionary, and the word Yisrael, which is exclusionary. So we have to have certain things that are left out and certain things that are included. And so what the Gemara says is that balance is created by the different types of women here. If she was both conceived and born while or after her mother had converted, in that case, she's a Yisraelit Gemura. We don't need the Psukim to deal with that at all. In a case that it was Horata Shelo B'Kdusha, Veledata Shelo B'Kdusha, she was both conceived and born prior to the conversion of her mother. In that case, she would be excluded from this Parsha because it says Yisrael. And that means it's only about Yisrael, it's not about the Gerim. The middle case is the case of Horata Shelo B'Kdusha and Veledata B'Kdusha, where she was conceived before the conversion, but only born after the conversion. In that instance, then she will be included by the word Meita for the death penalty and have a similar death penalty to Yisraelit. But with regards to the rest of the Parsha of Motzi Shemra, she would not be included because it says there, Bitulat Yisrael, and she would be excluded from that part of the dinim of Motzi Shemra. Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, HaMotzi Shemra Ale Yitoma Patur. Person who is Motzi Shemra on an orphan is patur from the penalties that are associated with Motzi Shemra. Shenamar, because the Pasuk says, as we saw before, V'natinu l'avia ne'ara. They have to give the penalty to the father of the ne'ara. Prat l'zo she'en la'av. To the exclusion of this girl who does not have a father. So he is taking the Pasuk very literally and saying that the avia ne'ara says that the only time that there's Motzi Shemra paid is when we're talking about a case where there is a via ne'ara. So this girl's Yutoma does not have a via ne'ara, would be then for excluded from the parsha. Meitiv Rav Yossi bar Avin, Viteimar Rav Yossi bar Zvida, Vimain Yimain Avia. So here this is a pasuk that's found by the case of Mifateh, and it says there that if the father refuses to give over the girl to the seducer, and we learned out earlier that Imain Yimain comes to include the girl herself, both the father and the daughter have a right of refusal in this marriage to the Mifateh. The Rabot Yitoma Leknas, Divrei Rabbi Yossi Aglili. That comes to teach you that even a Yitoma is subject to Knas, even though there is no Aviha Ne'ara. Now, how that is learned is not so clear. First of all, that's the case of Mifateh. It's not the case of Motzi Shemra. So how do we ever get over to Motzi Shemra? As Rashi points out over here, that it's clear that we have this Hekesh between, or Gzer Shava between Mifateh and Me'anes. And therefore, the dinim that apply by Mifateh will also apply by Me'anes. And what you see from Ima'ein, Yima'ein, is that this girl has a right of refusal even after the death of her father. So therefore, you see from this that we don't take a viha literally, because even in the face of not having an av, you still grant her the right of refusal. So therefore we see from this that the word av or avia is not to be taken literally. And therefore the same should be applicable by Motzi Shemra, just like by Me'anes. We see that avia is not taken literally, or the avia ne'ara is not taken literally, so too over here by Motzi Shemra, we should not take it literally. Now as Tosafot points out, this seems to be a somewhat circumspect way of getting a proof against this position of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Chanina. But Tosafot points out that maybe we could have learned this out of our Mishnah or from other locations. And therefore, Tosafot shows that Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina's position is premised in the Shita of Rabbi Yossi Aglili. We saw earlier a machlok between Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yossi Aglili, what you do with the diukim when someone or some item is missing from the Parsha. What does that mean? Does that mean that we eliminate it entirely? Or according to Rabbi Kiva, that just means that if there's no father, it goes to the daughter. So, therefore, what Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina can say is that Rabbi Kiva is the author of our Mishnah, is the author of these other Mishnayot that say that there is entitlement to the Yitoma in those instances. And what Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina is saying is, I hold like Rabbi Yossi Aglili, that when something is missing from the Parsha, if you cannot accomplish what's written in the Parsha, then the whole Parsha goes away. So see here, the lack of Aviya Na'ara should eliminate the need to pay Knas entirely. Therefore, the Gemara brings the question from Rabbi Yossi Aglili and saying, Lishitatcha, Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, who you hold like Rabbi Yossi Aglili, we can show you that even according to Rabbi Yossi Aglili, he doesn't take the word Av literally, and he allows a yitoma to collect in the case of mifateh and in the case of me'anes. So the same thing should be true here by the case of motzi shemra. So who motiv la, v'hu mefarek la? Rav Yossi bar Zvida asked the question, posed the question, and he also answered it, which is, was the case where the crime or the infraction happened while the father was still alive, and then she was only became a yitoma after the fact. So at the time of the infraction, there was a via nara, and that's why in that instance, Rav Yossi Aglili says that you pay it or you still pay the fine. But had she been a yitoma at the time of the infraction, then even Rav Yossi Aglili would agree that there would be no knas paid, and therefore it would support this position of Rav Yossi bar Chanina. Rava disagrees with Rav Yossi bar Chanina and says, Chayav, in this instance where there was a yitoma involved in Yabotzi Shemra, then the party would still be chayav to pay the fines. Mimai, how does he know this? Miditani ami, because we have this braito, bitulat Yisrael, velo bitulat gerim, that we have from the parsha of Motzi Shemra. Over there it says bitulat Yisrael, and that comes to exclude a bitulat gerim. And that's why a gioret is excluded from the parsha of Motzi Shemra. Iyamar bishlama ki hagavno b'Yisrael michayev. So if in a case where a Israelite had the exact same setup, the individual who perpetrated the crime would be chayav, then hainu d'itzrich kra the mute gerim. That's why we need a pasuk to come exclude gerim. Eliyah amart b'Yisrael ki hagavna patur. But if you had a case like this, a yitoma that was an Israelite gemura, and the perpetrator of the crime in that case would be patur from motzi shemra, hashte Yisrael patur b'gerim mibayi. Here in a case where a Yisraelite, in that instance where she was the Yitoma, the perpetrator of the crime would be Patur, then certainly by a case of Gerim, he would be Patur. Because, as Rashi points out, a Gyored, by definition, halachically, is a Yitoma. So if in a case of Yitoma, there is no din of Motzi Shemra, even when the Yitoma is a Yisraelite, then when it comes to a gyoret, alachat kama v'kama, then certainly she would not have a din of motzi shemra. And so then why do you need the limud from the bright of bitulat Yisrael and not bitulat gerim? It must be that in the case of yitoma Yisraelit, that there is a chiyuv of motzi shemra. And because of that, I need a specific limud to tell me by a gyoret that that is not the case, that it's bitulat Yisrael and not bitulat gerim. Because as Rashi explains, that by definition, when a person converts, they lose all relationships. So based on that, a gioret is defined as a yitoma because she has no connection, she has no yichus back to her father. Now Rashi says that even prior to her conversion, there's really no yichus for goyim. But certainly after conversion, that is the case that there is no yichus because a ger is ketino shenolad dami. And therefore, they are no different than a yitoma. So what Rava says is that you would only need a miut if the underlying issue was not a problem by Yisraelit. And therefore it must be that a yitoma is relevant in the parsha of Motzi Shemra. Okay, now we move on to another statement about Motzi Shemra. Amar Ish Lakish, a Motzi Shemra laktana patur. Shlakish says that a case of Motzi Shemra with regards to a ktana is patur. You don't pay the fines. Shenamar. Because it says in the pasuk there again, v'natnu via ne'ara. Ne'ara malei dibera katuv. Because over there it says that he gives the monies to the father of the ne'ara. And ne'ara there is spelled malei with a hey in it. So ne'ara must be taken literally. Ne'ara and not a ktana. Because over there the Torah writes ne'ara with a hey and does not write it chaser like it writes in other places, which is nun ayin resh. Even though it's pronounced ne'ara, it's written without a hey. As we discussed before, the word na'ar would be true even of a tana, because in that case, even though you pronounce it na'ra, it's still, na'ar is also included. And which girl looks like a na'ar? That's a tana. So therefore, the word na'ra, when it's spelled as nunayin resh, has a broader inclusionary meaning, which means both tana and na'ra. But when it's written with a hey, it literally means na'ra. So Reish Lakish says over here by Motzi Shemra, where it's written with a hey, it's clear that it means literally ne'ara, and that means that the parsha of Motzi Shemra is not relevant to a ktana. So matkiv la Rav Acha bar Avo, taima dichtiv ba ha ne'ara. halavachi. It's only because the word ne'ara is written in mle'a in the pasuk. That's why you have this limud. Had it not been for this, havaminu afilu ktana, then I would have thought that ktana is included in that parsha. Haktiv, it says in the parsha, v'imemet haya davar hazeh. If what the claim of the husband is saying is true, that she had an extramarital affair when she was an arusa, lo nimtzu bitulim ne'ara, and this girl did not have bitulim, v'utziu et ne'ara petach beit aviyah, uskulua. You take her out to the doorway of her father's house, and you stone her. Uktana, labot unshinji. But uktana is not subject to penalties or punishment. So how could you claim that the parsha of Motzi Shema speaking about uktana, uktana is not relevant to the rest of the parsha? Ela kan ne'ara. So eno achanami. In the end, what you can prove from here is that clearly Motzi Shema, uktana is not relevant in that parsha. Now, once we know that uktana is not relevant in that parsha, now we know what the meaning of the word ne'ara Malay means. That whenever the word ne'ara is spelled with a hey, it means dafka ne'ara and not ktana. How do I know it's not talking about ktana? Because the parsha certainly can't be talking about a ktana because a ktana is not but onshin, and the rest of the parsha, Motzi Shemra, is not relevant to that individual. Hakom akom shne'ara nar, that implies for us that anywhere else where it says the word na'ar without a hey, it's spelled chaser afilu ktana b'mashma. That's even inclusionary of a ktana. And that's why the Rabbanon believed by the case of Me'anes and Mifateh, it is applicable to a ktana, because by Me'anes it spells it as a nar, chaser, even though it's talking about a ne'ara. And that's why the Chachamim, against the position of Rabbi Meir, believed that the parsha of Me'anes applies both to a ne'ara and to a ktana. And with regards to Mifateh, the same is true with a little nuance to it, because the parsha of Mifateh applies to a ne'ara, but as we qualify this in the Gemara Yevamot, that the pitui of a ktana is considered like ones, is considered to be like rape, and therefore would jump over to the parsha of anes rather than the parsha of mifuta. So therefore, again, it would come under that inclusionary ktana in the parsha of anes. Tani shila shlosh midot binara. There are three different situations and circumstances with regards to an era. Baula edim bebet chamia. If edim show up when she's already married and she's in the house of her in-laws, she's zinta bebeit aviha, that she had had an extramarital affair during the time period of Erusin, then soklim otah petach beit aviha. Then we take her back to the doorstep of her father's house. Klomar, u'gidlim she gidaltem. Look at this, what you brought up. Look at this daughter that you produced, and look what she's doing. Ba'ulo yidim bebeit aviha, she's zinta bebeit aviha. If while she's still in her father's house prior to going to Nisuim, the Edim come and say that she had an extramarital affair, that she had this extramarital affair while she was still in her father's house. While she was still in Arusa, they come and tell us this. So, klimatal petach sharair. Then we stone her at the city gate. And that is because the petach beit aviha is only written in the case where the Edim come while she is in her in-law's house, because that's a case where the marriage was consummated, and it's a case of Motzi Shemra, where he already consummated the marriage through Nisuin. Therefore, the din of petach beit aviha is only required when you have all the circumstances that are true by Motzi Shemra, which is that she's in her in-law's house. But in her father's house, then she's subject to the punishment of a ne'ara merasa, but she'll be taken out to the petach sharair like any other death penalty, which means that it'll be done publicly so people understand or know why she's being killed, and they take a lesson from that. Sarcha ulesof bagra. If she had this extramarital affair and then became older, meaning she's no longer a ne'ara, tidon bechenek, then she's subject to the normal penalty of a woman who has an extramarital affair, which is chenek. And now the Gemara is going to ask, the memra, from this you would conclude, cholhecha dishtani gufa, ishtani ktala. Anytime that her body changes, meaning that she matures, then her death penalty matures. And the Gemara is going to make questions challenging this idea that just because she became bogeret, doesn't mean that the din mita should change over here. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines down on the top of Mem Hei Amud Aleph.